the next case.
Short Bank and another versus Harvard, Scott W. Tessman, appellant counsel, Charles M. Sims, William H. Schumate, John Jack, and Robert M. Allen.
All right, Madam Clerk, don't start the clock just yet until we figure out who's going to be arguing first.
Yes, sir. May it please the Court.
You have yielded 5 minutes of your time, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so you're going to argue first.
Yes, sir.
All right. Is there someone to move for admission?
Your Honor, may it please the Court. My name is Scott Kesman. I represent the appellants, Shore Bank and Hampton Roads Bank Shares, Inc. Before I begin my argument, I would like to introduce to the Court Elisa Klein. Ms. Klein is a member in good standing of the Bars of Pennsylvania and the District of Columbia. She is an attorney on the appellate staff of the United States Justice Department and has been admitted pro hoc vice to represent the United States in this matter.
All right, Ms. Klein, you're very welcome to be here. All right, now, Madam Clerk, we're going to reset that clock. 15 minutes aside, is there any rebuttal being reserved?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes.
All right, that's coming off of your time.
Yes.
All right, Madam Clerk, you set the clock to 10 minutes, and we'll see how well he keeps to it. You may proceed.
Thank you. This case is not the usual case, I think, that comes before this court. In this case, the circuit court held that a federal law that was enacted as part of the Troubled Asset Relief Program it essentially took from the appellee, Scott Harvard, his contractual right to a golden parachute payment without just compensation. The interesting part is,
did they take it, or did the Congress simply hold it was unenforceable?
Well, I would. The circuit court held that it was a taking by the United States. That is in the circuit court's letter opinion.
Well, I'm asking what the actual statute did.
The actual statute prohibited my clients, because they were TARP recipients, from making the golden parachute payment. That's what the statute did.
So that's a congressional act holding a contract void, voidable, whatever you want to call it, unenforceable, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, courts do that all the time, and
yes.
we don't take property without due process. Would it be any different if we were to hold as a matter of common law that a certain provision of an employee agreement is unlawful under common law principles and therefore cannot be enforced? Would that be a taking?
I don't think it would be a taking, Your Honor. For example, that certainly can happen, that the court could hold that contractual provision violates public policy, for example.
Well, can't the legislature do that? Because that's their whole job, is to determine public policy.
Yes, we think the legislature absolutely can do that. And in fact, in this case, you got to go back to the circumstances of what was going on in the country at that time. The financial system was literally melting down. The credit markets had frozen up, and Congress decided to take action. And the action that they chose was the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And that program was to invest capital in primarily financial institutions, but others, there were other wings to the program. In doing so, the hope was that this would help restore the liquidity and stability of the financial system. And Congress made a judgment. That judgment was, look, these golden parachute payments, they're not going to either enhance the stability or the liquidity of the financial system. If we make this investment, this TARP investment, in a financial institution, and it then turns around, and has happened here, Mr. Harvard voluntarily quit his employment and said, hey, I got this contract, pay me. If that's happening, and what happens is that there's a large capital outflow then to pay this golden parachute payment, that's not enhancing the liquidity of the institution. I mean, the purpose of the investment was to enhance liquidity so that these financial institutions could make loans. That's what they were intending to do here. Now, stability. The vision of the United States.
Isn't the point that they're making against the simplistic take versus non-take analysis is the government is getting something out of this. The government is protecting its own treasury investment in these various bank corporations. That's very different, actually, from simply saying in a statute that a provision is unenforceable or void as a matter of law.
Well, again, if you look at the purpose of TARP, it's to protect, to enhance and preserve the stability and the liquidity. We've talked about liquidity, stability. If the public money is treasury is going into these institutions, making an investment, and then you have executives, senior executives, the people who make policy for these institutions, are able to voluntarily quit and receive large payments from these institutions with what is going to be perceived as public money, that is not going to enhance stability. It's not going to enhance confidence. So there is a benefit to that to the United States. Is there, as an investor, is there a tangential benefit, perhaps, to the United States?
And appreciating that that point that you're making, I want to drill down on what the law is that we need to apply in this case. And particularly, I have a question about A&D Auto. Okay.
Yes.
In your brief, you cite A&D for your secondary proposition, which is if there is a taking, this needs to go to the Federal Court of Claims.
Yes.
That's the only cite to A&D. Now, your opponents cite A&D passim because their position is that that A&D actually controls in terms of, not in terms of jurisdiction, but in terms of the substantive law, that there was a taking there and that they are wrapping their argument around A&D, that we are very similar to those franchises, that those are TARP cases, those were contract expectations or property interests, and therefore that was a taking and this is a taking. In your reply, you don't respond to that argument. You do cite A&D, but it's only for the proposition of using the Penn Central three-part analysis. I'd like to know, is A&D substantially similar to this case? And if not, why not? And having put that on the table, if you would like to answer it during the rebuttal time, that would be fine. I'm sensitive to how little time you have to make your argument.
No, I'm happy to address that now, Your Honor. In A&D is different in that there was no statutory prohibition in A&D. All right. What was going on in A&D, the allegations, and the court throughout A&D says, you know, this is kind of a strange case. This doesn't fit readily within takings jurisprudence. What was going on in A&D was the auto companies had to submit a plan to the United States in order to get this financial assistance under TARP, under the auto wing of TARP. And they had to submit a plan, and the United States got to review the plan and say, you know what, you need to cut. We think you need to cut more dealers to make this a viable entity. But there's no, but they never enacted any legislation saying that. This was all behind the scenes. So it was, and they say that in A&D. They say specifically, no allegation that the government either by statute, regulation, or direct order required the termination of the dealers.
Now, I do want to be efficient. Like I said, I'm very concerned about the amount of time. Second of all, does everyone agree that the Penn Central three-part analysis is the analysis that we should use if we find that the state court has jurisdiction? And I know you're arguing it doesn't, but if we get there.
It is an analysis, and I'll be prepared to address that on my rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
You may proceed.
Elisa Klein for the United States. Thank you for hearing from us as amicus. If I could start with the question just asked.
Yes.
We think two lines of U.S. Supreme Court doctrine come together to answer that question. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly held that it is not a taking for the government to override, eradicate the terms of a private contract. For the same reason, if you were to apply the Penn Central framework to a bare-bones claim that government action overrode the terms of my contract, the result would be no taking because under Penn Central, a threshold showing is that there is a reasonable investment-backed expectation that, you know, this government action would not occur. And what the Supreme Court has said is private contracts have a congenital infirmity. They are always subject to revision by government action. And the Supreme Court said it not only in the pre-Penn Central cases, Norman and Omnia, but also in the post-Penn Central line, most recently in the Concrete Pipe 1993 decision. We cite all of these in our brief, but there the court, in reiterating what it had said long ago in Norman and Omnia, is quoting Connolly, another of the Penn Central line, in turn quoting Norman.
And your position is that we are able to reach those issues here as a state Supreme Court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, if we are, wouldn't Penn Central be the right way to get to it?
We are comfortable with a court saying under Penn Central the claim fails because a senior executive cannot reasonably expect that the terms of a contract that provide for a golden parachute will not be revised by Congress. That's both as a general proposition, but also in the particular context of these provisions. And I know the court is familiar with the sequence, but just very briefly, of course, there was a financial crisis. You had October 2008 emergency legislation in which Congress said no golden parachutes, did not define the term. Treasury, in its interim regulations, came in and, borrowing from an Internal Revenue Code provision, defined that term to mean three times base pay. However, the securities purchase agreement at issue in this case explicitly reserved Treasury's right to unilaterally amend the agreement to comply with changes in federal statutes. Congress, just months later, in February 2009, said, no, when we said no golden parachutes, we meant no golden parachutes, zero times base pay.
Does the United States take a position on whether the attorney's fees that were awarded come under the definition of under the prohibition on golden parachutes, or does the United States not take
that? We're not taking a position on that issue.
Well, but the reg talks about any payment, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I understand the question. Our positions are authorized by the Solicitor General of the United States, and so I have to be careful to address only the issues that I'm authorized to address.
I understand. So you're going to throw him under the bus.
Very able.
All right.
So I'm hoping I answered Your Honor's question, which is that either line, they converge, because in general, private contracts can be overridden by Congress, or, you know, federal agencies acting pursuant to Congress. And here in particular, these executive compensation programs were subject to intense scrutiny by Congress where you're in the midst of a financial crisis.
So what you're really saying, and tell me if I've synthesized it right, is Penn Central presupposes some sort of semi-vesting reliance on government, some sort of reasonable expectation that government is not going to be doing this.
Exactly.
So we wouldn't go to the three-part test, the four-part test, if we don't cross that first threshold issue.
Perhaps more precisely, one element of the three-part test is a reasonable investment-backed expectation.
But each element is conjunctive, right?
Each element has to be satisfied. Right. And because you cannot satisfy that element when what you are saying is, I had a private contract, right? The answer is, so what? The Supreme Court has repeatedly said that Congress, you know, federal law can override your private contract.
Would you mind if we don't say so what?
No, I'm
with regards to private contract rights, we're a little touchy on those things.
Very briefly, though, there is a flavor to the case that doesn't seem quite right, and the flavor is that the Treasury is protecting its own interests too, not just the interests of all of us.
I'm glad the court asked that question. That is definitely the flavor of the circuit court opinion. And I just want to give the kind of practical reality, but then also the doctrine to look at. Of course, this wasn't Treasury entering into investments in the usual sense, which to enrich the taxpayer. There were no competitors. This was a financial crisis, and in order to protect the economy from a depression, Congress authorized hundreds of billions of dollars of federal funds to be infused into troubled banks. And to make sure that money would be used to restore liquidity, to keep banks lending, Congress imposed a number of restrictions, including this money can't go towards executive compensation. And it's a prohibition, so can't go now, and you can't evade that just by having deferred liability for this very executive compensation. So, yes, in a sense, Treasury was protecting, you know, ultimate taxpayer liability, but the primary objective here was to protect the stability of the economy. And in that sense, I would refer the court to the concrete pipe analysis of the argument that this new withdrawal liability for pension plans would inure to the benefit of the PBGC, which is the federal agency responsible for insuring underfunded pension plans. And what the Supreme Court said was, you know, I'm not disagreeing, but that wasn't the primary objective of the statute, the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act, and rejected the takings analysis. And the same reason would apply here.
All right. Any further questions from the bench?
I see that my time is up.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You now can see the wisdom of dividing your time so that her overtime does not get charged against your rebuttal. All right.
Good morning. My name is William Shoemaker. I represent the Appellee Scott Harvard. At the council table with me is Charles Sims and John Jack Robb. As to the first assignment of error, we submit the dispositive question is whether or not Penn Central applied. In this case, the trial court found that the government purchased stock in the bank pursuant to a stock purchase agreement in which it was specifically identified as the investor. And as a condition of their acquisition and that commercial transaction, it required the bank to get Mr. Harvard to agree that he would voluntarily reduce his change in control severance benefit and waive his rights for any claims for voluntarily agreeing. The court then found that after the transaction closed, that the government decided to enhance its own investment position in its stock purchase, and it retroactively tried to eliminate Mr. Harvard's severance rights in this case.
You know, counsel, Section 5.3 of the TARP agreement, which was signed when Mr. Harvard was the principal operating officer of the bank, reserves Treasury's right to, quote, unilaterally amend any provision in this agreement to the extent required to comply with any changes after the signing date in applicable federal statutes, which is what we're dealing with here, a change in a federal statute that prohibits woven parachutes. So understood that it was retroactive, but there was a provision in the TARP contract that permitted retroactivity vis-a-vis those two contracting parties, the federal government and the bank. Now, since Mr. Harvard was the principal officer of the bank at the time, surely he was on notice of that provision.
Your Honor, my response would be twofold. As the trial court found, looking at the totality of that language, the trial court found that while the bank may have anticipated that it would be subject to general banking laws, it was not an investment-backed expectation that you would go retroactively, especially after you've required a voluntary waiver of the employee, and totally eliminate his severance benefits, which is a finding of fact. But the second
in terms of the de novo review of the contract itself, which we will review de novo, does that mean anything other than what I just indicated?
No, because I don't necessarily know it's de novo, because the issue is what was the understanding of what that meant. So I think the inferences can be made in favor of Mr. Harvard, but I would also point out that Mr. Harvard was not a party to that contract.
My question presupposed that.
Okay. And so when you're looking at the analysis, and what Penn Central says is it is fact-intensive. You have to look at every single factor in there and every fact. And in this fact, the court looked at the contract, the extensive contract, believed that wouldn't put Mr. Harvard on notice that he would be retroactively eliminated from his severance benefits after they've already required him to voluntarily agree. And the court also noted that Mr. Harvard is not a party to that stock purchase agreement. All he agreed as an individual, as his for his benefits, was I will, to help my employer, I'll agree to voluntarily reduce my severance to 3 times, and I'll agree to waive any claims I have from that. But he did not sign any agreement whatsoever that says, and then I'm going to allow the government to come in as a shareholder and wipe out all my benefits. He never signed an agreement, isn't
that? Well, first of all, counsel, all of his benefits were not wiped out. There's in the reply brief, there's an entire page of his rather generous benefits. Do you factually dispute that he got everything other than the golden parachute?
Oh, we believe that was severable, so there was a finding of fact of the trial court that
I understand, but do you disagree that he received all the benefits that are listed in the reply brief?
He received most of the benefits listed in the reply brief, but the major loss, and this is a factor analysis, is the 3 times his compensation of $655,000.
Yeah, it's nothing small. Now, if we disagree with your roadmap and we apply Penn Central, you take the position that you meet the 3-part Penn Central test.
Absolutely.
Okay. How does your how do you meet the distinct investment-backed expectation? I just heard you say, I believe, that the investment-backed expectation relates to the government, whereas I thought that as I apply this, I'm looking at the expectation of the injured party. And so, if I'm correct in that, how does Mr. Harvard have an investment-backed expectation here?
He has an investment-backed expectation because he had a contract right. Absent what the government did to protect its own investment retroactively, he had a contract right to $655,000. And so the court found on these facts, especially when the government came to him ahead of time and led him to believe that they would need his voluntary acquiescence, and that's why he was required to voluntarily reduce it and sign a waiver, which was a factor the trial court, which has the weight of a jury verdict on these facts, could determine that helped give him an investment-backed expectation that the government, after buying stock, couldn't wipe him out. The second...
I understand he had an expectation, but where was the investment-backed aspect of it? Are you saying that the amount of the reduction of his prior golden parachute equals an investment back, because he put money back on the table?
No, the investment back is his contract right to the benefits. When the court is using investment back, when he entered into his employment agreement, he agreed that he was going to provide certain services, enter into a covenant not to compete, and that in exchange, he was getting a contract right to change of control severance benefits. So when he entered into that contract, that created an expectation that he would receive those benefits if those conditions were satisfied.
Do you have any cases that say that an investment-backed expectation is satisfied by a mere executory contract?
Well, I would say this. For example, in the Seneca Gardens case, in which the parties, it was involving a contract for mortgages and subsidized housing, and there had initially been in the contracts between the private parties, the bank, the lender on the one hand, and the person who was taking out the loan, that they could prepay the loan balance itself.
Okay, yeah, we're familiar. That's a very good case. Is there anything other than Seneca Gardens? Again, I don't want to take up all of your time with this.
I understand, but we think that applies. I think we look at A&D Auto sales, where in that case, the court found that not even a regulation, but the coercion could state a case under Penn Central. So we don't think you can say, because it didn't involve a regulation but merely coercion, that somehow A&D auto sales doesn't apply. We think an ex post facto application is even stronger than the facts in A&D. But the other case I would argue, Your Honor, is if you were to look at the Monsanto case, the Norman versus Monsanto case, where that court talks about That was a situation in which there was regulation in terms of submitting documents to the EPA, in which Monsanto thought it would have benefit of certain protection for trade secrets. And then the regulatory scheme changed. And the government argued that they didn't have investment-backed expectations because they always knew that the regulatory scheme could change, which is what they're arguing here. And the court said, no, that's not the case. Just because the regulatory scheme may change, that doesn't mean you don't have an expectation they won't do it retroactively.
Okay. My question's been answered. One of my colleagues to my left had a question, and I don't want to
I think the moment has passed.
I'm sorry.
That's correct. I wasn't strident enough in asserting myself, I think, perhaps.
I apologize, yeah. But we would also note that we believe that they've waived any argument as how the facts apply to Penn Central. If you look at their petition for appeal, and if you look at their opening brief, they never argue or talk about how the facts apply to the Penn Central test. And under the Jay versus Commonwealth case, 275 Virginia 510, and the rules of this court, we believe that waives the argument. But I would also note they really didn't talk about it in the court below and give the meaningful opportunity to the trial court to discuss and decide some of the arguments they're making here, for example, on the investment-backed expectations because it's in the financial industry. We would note we take issue with that. This was a tax and spend dealing with their investment in private enterprise. And how the government achieves its goals is critical. That's why it's the third prong in the Penn Central test, which is what is the character and nature of the government action. So they did not properly preserve the application of the facts to Penn Central. Their argument is Penn Central doesn't apply, that under Norman and under Omnia, unless they're physically taking the contract, the rights to the contract, then the government can do whatever it wants unless it's arbitrary and capricious.
I just thought I heard them say Penn Central would apply.
Well, I think that's why their case ends, because they did just say that. But if you look at their briefs, the petition for appeal, the opening brief, that is not what they said. They have maintained Penn Central doesn't apply, and they don't argue how those facts apply to Penn Central. The only time they did it was in the reply brief. I would also note, if you go to the trial record, we don't think it was sufficiently preserved, these arguments they're making now. But even then, you go to pages 101 to 103 of the transcript, which is where they were responding to a question of, well, what if this is a partial taking? And they touch upon what appears to be some elements in Penn Central. They don't talk about the TARP and how it was dealing with the financial crisis or anything like that. On the first prong, in which it goes to the impact of the government action, all they say is it was a partial take. That's it. On the investment-backed expectation, the only argument they make to the trial court below was something to the effect of, well, he got his other benefits, and so, you know, this really isn't an investment. Even though clearly he had a right and expectation that he would, his contract right would be respected. But they didn't make those other arguments. And then on the nature of the government action, they don't address the retroactive nature of the action, the targeted nature of the action. All they say on the nature of the government action in that case is, well, it only cut off 15 days. Of his time to exercise.
Counsel, may I ask you this? I'm still struggling to understand the scope of your basic argument.
Yes.
Suppose, hypothetically, there were no Treasury investment. Suppose there was a congressional act, completely different case, I acknowledge, and the congressional act said, pursuant to the Interstate Commerce Clause, Congress now deems golden parachute provisions at a ratio of 20 to 1, anything over that, to be unenforceable on public policy grounds. Period. Done. Would that mean that everybody with a parachute, a golden parachute, executory right under a contract would be able to sue the government for takings?
No, that's what Penn Central addresses, Your Honor. What Penn Central says is you cannot have a blanket rule. What Penn Central recognizes, and which it was synthesizing 50 or 60 years of case law because we've had an explosion of regulation. So what they tried to say is, okay, you can't have a bright line rule. So we have to look at the individual case applying these factors. So there may be many cases in which it would not be unconstitutional as applied. And this is an application case. So that would be the distinction that I would make. So if you look at, for example, their argument on the Norman case and the Omnia case, those cases do not stand for the proposition that if the government doesn't take the rights, therefore it can do what it wants. As the A&D Auto Court explained, no, it's very limited. What those cases only stand for is if Congress passes a law and it has an incidental or collateral impact on a contract, then that may not be unconstitutional as it applies to those contracts. So, for example, Norman just went to how you pay, whether you use gold as a form of payment. In the Omnia case, it wasn't targeting the individual contract, the party who had a contract with the steel plant. It was simply requisitioning the steel and paying for it. And so the impact and collateral source was collateral. In this case, this is almost more close to Perry, in which decided on the same day as Norman, in which the government got a direct benefit because it was their gold contract. And they said, no, the government can't benefit. In this case, if you apply Penn Central, you have a significant economic impact. You have his expectation that it wouldn't be retroactively destroyed in this case. And the nature of the government action is protecting its investment. Indeed, ESA says to maximize the returns to the United States taxpayer. And then it also says it was targeted and specific. What if they had had a rule that said, we're going to cut everybody's salaries by $100,000 no matter what you do, or double the interest rate on the borrowers? Would that be constitutional? No. Fact by fact, you apply Penn Central.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Kelsey just had a really interesting thought, and I want to take it one step further.
Yes.
What if Congress were to say that an American company cannot import oil from Iran? Again, under both the interstate commerce jurisdiction as well as jurisdiction relating to our national defense. And you are representing an American oil refiner who has a particular contract for Iranian oil, and that oil is at a very favorable rate. Your contract expectation, your contract has been wiped out. Your expectation, which is an investment-backed expectation because of what you have invested in your refinery, is wiped out. Is that a taken?
It would depend. Under Omnia, perhaps not, but what would happen is you do a three-prong analysis. And one of the problems they would have in that analysis is the nature of the government action. That's why how you do something matters. In that case, Congress is not trying to get an independent benefit for itself for the taxpayers, and it's not targeting my contract. That's collateral and incidental. That's far different from this case, Your Honor, in which they are specifically trying to maximize the returns under ESA, strengthen their investment position, and do that by targeting my client's specific contract and eliminating it.
They're eliminating the contracts of everybody who is similarly situated with your client, correct?
But that was a relatively few because this talk was a voluntary program.
But they don't name your client in the statute. It might be few, but it's a class, not an individual. And then second of all, was it merely to enhance their investment position, or was it also to restore confidence in the economy? We did have a national crisis going on.
Whether they decided to invest or not, I mean, that may have an incidental benefit of helping the economy, but their decision to retroactively eliminate the severance benefits absolutely enhanced and strengthened their investment position. Because that was one of the goals, is to enhance the investment returns of the taxpayer.
Thank you.
The government action is totally... That's the third prong in your example that I think is fundamentally different, the nature of the government action. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Rebuttal. You have 2 minutes and 21 seconds.
May it please the Court, I guess I would like to get to the other assignments of error, but first, this is a quote out of the Connolly case, which we cited in our opening brief and in our reply brief. It says, appellant's claim of an illegal taking gains nothing from the fact that the employer in the present litigation was protected by the terms of its contract from any liability beyond the specified contributions to which it has agreed. Contracts, however expressed, cannot fetter the constitutional authority of Congress. Contracts may create rights of property, but when contracts deal with a subject matter which lies within the control of Congress, they have a congenital infirmity. Parties cannot remove their transactions from the reach of dominant constitutional power by making contracts about them. Maybe it's a simplified view, but when I look at what's the most analogous case to this, the most analogous case is clearly Norman. It was enacted during the Great Depression, during a financial crisis. Congress targeted specific contract rights, eliminated them. People made a claim that it was a taking, and you know what? The Supreme Court said it's not a taking. This is an area of congressional power. They have the power to do this. The question is,
your argument would be very persuasive if there were no Treasury expectations in this case and no self-interest on the part of the government. That's the wild card that makes this case seemingly unlike any others that y'all have cited to us.
It's a wild card, absolutely. But again, I would submit, as Counsel for the United States did, the protection of the Treasury's investment is an ancillary benefit. The primary benefit was to restore confidence and stability and liquidity to the financial system in the U.S. Now, very briefly, Mr. Harbert has never asked, the Circuit Court clearly found the taking, if there was one here, was by the United States. And while we don't think there was a taking, if there was a taking, his remedy is to ask for just compensation from the United States. That is the remedy for a taking. He said, well, it was an as-applied challenge. Well, it's interesting. In his brief, he hasn't cited one case of an as-applied challenge to a federal statute in a state court. And the reason is simple. As Judge Poston said, the federal folks have no obligation to honor anything I do, and I can't order the federal folks to do anything. So they put my clients between a rock and a hard place. He has a remedy. He could have clearly, and he's acknowledged he had the remedy. He could have gone to the Court of Claims under the Tucker Act. That's where you sue for just compensation.
You're in the middle of a state court jurisdiction, no federal court jurisdiction sandwich.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Your opponent suggests that it's not the modification of golden parachutes, it's the retroactive modification of those benefits. How do you respond to that?
I would respond to that the same way. That's exactly what happened in Norman. These gold clauses were in existing private contracts. The purpose of the gold clause was to hedge against inflation, or I guess the deflation of the currency. That's exactly what happened. Congress went off the gold standard. It cost these people 69 cents on every dollar in those contracts. Those were clearly contracts that were in existence. Those rights were extinguished. It's the same here.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.